From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When America started fracking the crust of this great continent and shale oil and gas began to gush, it was clear it was a big deal. But we're still taking on board just how big. A supply shock out of North America, they're calling it now, with the capacity to reshape global economics, geopolitics, and power in big ways. That same abundance could wreck the climate. This hour on Point, the blessing, curse, and global implications of America as the new fossil fuels powerhouse. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Did you ever dream American shale oil and gas could be such a game changer? Are you more focused on the blessing or the curse of all that fossil fuel? Can we bring the ships home now from the Persian Gulf and let somebody else police that part of the world? Joining me now from Paris, first today, is Antoine Hauff, head of the Oil Industry and Markets Division of the International Energy Agency. Last week, the IEA issued a boringly named annual report, the Medium-Term Oil Market Report. But the press release, along with it, hinted at the scale of its implications. Supply shock from North American oil rippling through global markets. Well, Mr. Hauff was the lead author and editor of that report. Anton Hauff, thank you very much for being with us. Hello, Mr. Hauff, are you there?
Yes, thank you.
Yes, thank you for joining us. We're on the air. What's the bottom line of your report in the coming years? What's the energy outlook out of North America?
What is the outlook out of North America?
Yes.
Well, we're seeing a lot of production growth coming from North America, which is a big reversal from trends existed just a few years ago. And it's a very significant development, not just for North America itself, but for the market as a whole.
It was just last year, your outfit said by 2020, the United States could well overtake Saudi Arabia as the number one oil producer. What about in terms of the growth in fossil fuel energy supplies in the next 5 years? Where do you see most of that growth or the biggest growth coming from globally?
Well, you know, looking specifically at hydrocarbons, at oil, most of the growth in oil production and in oil capacity in the next few years is likely to come from North America. U.S., we contribute the largest increment. Canada will be a large contributor as well. And then in South America, we see production growth in Brazil. And this is really going to lead production growth globally. Now, at the same time, OPEC countries and Middle East countries remain large producers, and we do see some increases in Iraq, particularly increases in the UAE, increases in Saudi Arabia, but conditioned to certain sufficient stability politically to a number of conditions, which we have to watch carefully.
Mr. Hauff, what are the presumptions in your projections here? Do they, for example, include more fossil fuel coming out of Canada's tar sands and the Keystone XL pipeline being opened up, or not?
Second?
In your projection of big growth here, are you assuming that the tar sands of Canada will be a big contributor?
Yes, okay. I'm changing the way I'm receiving you. We had some problems with the connection.
Yeah.
So, yes, we are seeing increases in production from Canada, from the tar sands. But at the same time, I think we're cautioning that this growth that we're expecting from North America, from the U.S., from Canada, will require significant adjustments in terms of infrastructure, in terms of logistics, transportation links, perhaps refining capacity, and even in terms of regulations, we may need to see some adjustments in regulations in order to absorb this new production and make it possible to bring it to market. You know, the resource is there. That's one of the biggest game changers, if you like, of the last few years. It's a completely different story from what most people believed the narrative to be just a few years ago. But to bring the resource to market remains a challenge, And there's still some uncertainty in the picture looking forward for the next few years.
There are many people concerned about the climate who don't want the resource brought to market. There are many others who welcome it, hoping it will bring down energy prices. If you don't have the Keystone XL pipeline in the United States, for example, would North America still be this big growth source in energy supplies in the next 5 years and beyond?
Well, we try to stay away from taking a view on the impact of the Keystone pipeline decision. And in truth, we're not really sure that whether or not the pipeline will be approved will necessarily change the picture entirely. So in our forecast, we basically assume that Canadian oil will get to market regardless of whether the Keystone pipeline is approved or regardless of whether or when exactly the Keystone pipeline may or may not be coming online. You know, if that pipeline doesn't happen, other pipelines, other connections will happen. And indeed, just in the last few years, we've seen a very dramatic increase in transportation capacity, both pipelines, but also rail capacity. You know, the development of rail transport has been a major development in the U.S. as well as in Canada just in the last few years.
Give us a sense of how this new supply, new and growing supply, is hitting markets and economies around the world. Your report says the shockwaves of rising U.S. shale gas, light tight oil, and Canadian oil sands production are reaching virtually all recesses of the global oil market. Give us some sense of the impact.
Well, there's something unique about the way this resource is reaching the market because it's unlike previous increases. In the past, we've seen cases of rapid increases or decreases in supply from the likes of Saudi Arabia, for instance, mm-hmm. without the kind of far-reaching consequences that we observe today in the market. So what's really unique about this new supply is not just the volumes, and the volumes are impressive, but also the fact that this new oil is of a very distinct quality, very different quality from the type of oil that we've seen incremental production in the last few years. So,
In what way?
Well, it's much lighter and much sweeter. It has a higher API, higher API gravity measurement.
These are all good things in energy terms, I guess.
Well, it's kind of good things in general, but it can be a challenge for refiners who have invested billions of dollars in equipment designed to remove the sulfur from higher sulfur crude grades, mm-hmm. which is the case of most large-scale refineries in the U.S. Gulf Coast. There's a challenge there to adjust to this new type of resource.
That light, sweet oil, that would not characterize what would come out of tar sands.
That's right. That's right. So in the case of Canadian production, it's mixed. You have both a very heavy, sour type of crude, which U.S. refiners in particular have invested to be able to absorb, to process, and to take advantage of, and to extract high-value light products from. But some of the Canadian production is also highly processed and comes out in the form of syncrude, which is also very light and sweet and competes directly with the kind of oil that we see coming out of the back end, for instance.
This growth of American oil supplies that has you projecting the U.S. overtaking Saudi Arabia by 2020, would that just be for a moment, or would it be an ongoing predominance? If the U.S. pulled that much oil out of the ground, how long would that position last?
Well, first of all, I think we need to backtrack a little bit from the comparison with Saudi Arabia because it's very difficult to predict how much Saudi Arabia will produce exactly. I think the comparison was more focused when it came out a few months ago mm-hmm. about, you have to distinguish between production and capacity. So in terms of capacity, we still think that Saudi Arabia may be the largest hydrocarbon producer, or at least the largest oil producer in the world. But Saudi Arabia is unique because it's a swing producer, which maintains a large amount of spare capacity, so it doesn't necessarily bring all its production capacity online. It keeps some as a safety cushion, if you'd like.
Of course.
So we have to take those comparisons between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia with a grain of salt. That being said, you're right. The increase in the U.S. May not continue forever, and there's still many uncertainties about the exact nature of this resource and how sustainable this growth may be. I think in our forecast, we assume that there's going to be continued growth until the early 2020s, and then we reach a plateau and we may see some decrease in production.
And do the shockwaves that you're describing here hitting the global market, do they depend on the U.S. becoming a major exporter, both of oil and of natural gas, or not?
Well, that's part of the story, but even without going to that stage, we see some shockwaves happening today. The U.S. is not a crude exporter today, not in a large way. There's mm-hmm. some small exports going on from the U.S. to Canada, for instance, but very much at the margin. But there's still a chain reaction that's rippling through the market, if you'd like, because this new U.S. production is not being taken directly to export markets, but it's displacing oil that the U.S. would otherwise or used to import. So it's creating a kind of domino effect, if you'd like. For instance, to take a specific example, the U.S. used to be a very large importer of crude from Nigeria. Much of that crude is now unnecessary because it's being replaced by light sweet crude from the Bakken and other light tight oil formations. So this Nigerian crude is now looking for markets elsewhere. And this is creating a kind of a chain reaction where different kinds of crudes have to look for new markets and those markets have to adjust. So it's a kind of chain reaction which is rippling through the market in many different ways.
Antoine Howe, please stand by at the IEA in Paris. We're talking this hour about North America as a new global fossil fuel powerhouse. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about North America as the new global fossil fuel powerhouse, the blessing, the curse, and how it may reshape geopolitics, energy politics, the climate. Out where it's happening, all kinds of concerns about fracking, but at the same time, kind of gold rush going on. Here's Russell Rankin, works for the Brigham Exploration Oil Company out in the Bakken Formation in North Dakota, talked with Canadian TV about just how much oil is in the ground there.
This is a huge basin. We're thinking 15 years of just drilling, and these wells are 30-year life wells. So you're talking about production from the Bakken Reservoir if at full development, you know, it's 45, 50, 60 years out. This is kind of the bright and shining star of the U.S. at this current time.
Bright and shining star. If those dollars are piling up in your bank account, if you're an environmentalist, maybe not so much. But the money is turning a lot of heads. Here's Fox Business News' Jeff Flock out in Stanley, North Dakota. Talked with Fred Evans, a cattle rancher making money hand over fist from oil rigs on his property.
Oil has turned many people into millionaires here in North Dakota. What am I looking at right there, Fred?
Well, that's a pumping unit, and it's a good-sized one, and it's pulling that Bakken oil, just helping it come on out of the ground and get in the tank, and they turn it into dollars.
There's the dollar side. The environmental side, not so pretty. And everybody looking now at the implications of North America emerging as a big fossil fuel resource center. Antoine Haft, please stand by there in Paris. With us now as well from New York is Michael Levy, Senior Fellow for Energy and the Environment, Director of the Program on Energy Security and Climate Change at the Council on Foreign Relations. His big book is The Power Surge, Energy Opportunity and the Battle for America's Future. Michael Levy, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Give us a sense of just how big a deal this is in energy terms, in geopolitical terms, Michael.
This is the biggest period of change in the energy world that we've seen in the last 40 years. If you go back to the early 1970s, you had the first oil shock, peak American oil production, the emergence of nuclear power, the birth of the modern environmental movement. And those had global consequences. We had a pretty sleepy time in most of the energy world for the next few decades, but now we're seeing record growth in U.S. oil production, natural gas passing coal as the top domestic source of American energy, doubling of renewable power in the last 4 years, and falling oil consumption for the first time in many decades. So all of those changes are creating big impacts on the ground. When you look around the world at the geopolitical consequences, I think the biggest ones we're seeing so far are in natural gas. Gas markets are pretty fractured. You depend on particular suppliers to get your gas, and they can use that as leverage. Some listeners may remember only a few years ago, when Russia got into a dispute with Europe and cut off a lot of the gas supplies, plunging the continent into the dark and cold in the middle of the winter.
That got their attention. That
certainly got their attention, and they could use that to gain leverage in pricing talks. Now, we're seeing an abundance of natural gas in large parts of the market. The United States was supposed to be a big importer of natural gas. Producers, particularly Qatar, built up their capacity to supply gas to the United States. And lo and behold, the United States wasn't there to buy it. So they turned and put it onto the European market. Europeans had more choices. When you have more choices, you have more leverage. And now you don't see Russia turning off the gas. You see Russia giving Europeans a better deal on their natural gas supplies and the deal the Europeans are asking for. So that is already a geopolitical impact that we're seeing.
What about U.S. relations in the Middle East, Michael Levy? I mean, we all have seen the pictures of FDR way back when, sitting on the boat, was it in the Red Sea, with the Saudis king, and making this pact, essentially, that, you know, the United States would look after security there as long as they kept the oil coming. Now I'm reading headlines. This is from the Wall Street Journal asking, is it the end of the crude alliance between the United States and the Middle East? You know, painting this picture of maybe the United States doesn't have to be so deeply involved there with the Fifth Fleet in the Persian Gulf and all the rest. What about it?
I wish that were the case, but I don't think that the impact of the U.S. oil boom goes that far. The reality is that we're part of an integrated global market. We've spent 40 years trying to become more integrated in order to make ourselves more secure. But what that means is that even if however many years from now North America were to produce all the oil it consumed, if there was a big incident in the Middle East, the price of oil here would spike and we would suffer economically. And because we're scared of that, we'll take steps to try and maintain stability in the region. A couple years ago, when the Libyan civil war broke out, the price of oil from Canada increased by more than the price of oil from the Middle East did. This is despite the fact that Canada was not in a civil war and was a country that was exporting oil. So I don't think that we are going to be able to pull away. What I do think will happen is that people's perceptions will change, and that will have broad impacts. When I was writing my book, I traveled in the Middle East. I also traveled to Vienna to meet with the head of OPEC. Mm-hmm. And what you heard consistently was a fear that the United States would pull out, a belief that the United States would no longer be there. And in China, you also hear worries that the United States will no longer protect the sea lanes. When leaders believe that the United States may be on its way out, they're going to invest in stepping up, whether it's in their own relationships with others, their own military investments, their own security measures, and those will have broad consequences regardless of what the United States ultimately does.
Antoine Haff, I believe an earlier report from your group, the International Energy Agency, said talked about the United States energy independence by 2030. We've thought about that for a long time. What about that projection? Is it solid? Is it real? And what does it mean in terms of the U.S. Relationship with energy sources abroad?
Well, I think you have to be very clear that independence doesn't mean isolation. So just because you become less dependent on imports, more able to rely on your own resources, or more able to maintain a more balanced level of imports and exports, doesn't mean you're divorced from the market. The oil market will remain very much a unified market. As Michael said, price effects can be seen from events in one part of the market to markets at the opposite end of the world. But also, I think something to keep in mind is that this revolution in supply in the U.S. will not remain an exclusively U.S. phenomenon. And there may be shale developments elsewhere. It's probably going to take a few years more than the next 5 years to bring those resources to market if they are commercially available and can be developed. But some of the techniques that have been developed in conjunction with the new U.S. supply can have applications in basins elsewhere, including in conventional oil plays, where they can increase the recovery rates, if you'd like. And we are seeing today producers ranging from Russia to Saudi Arabia to China applying some of the technologies that have been developed in the Bakken and elsewhere to increase their own production rates.
So fracking, not just in the United States, but all over the world. I wonder, Michael, about China's footprint here. if the United States becomes more energy independent, not isolated, as Antoine says, but more independent, what does that mean for China? For we saw just last week, I think India and China moving into top spot in terms of energy consumption. How does China's relationship with other key producers in the Middle East, even in the Americas, change if the U.S. has more of its own resources at home?
The big barrier to a change in Chinese relationship, or at least the Chinese security position here, is that they don't have the capacity right now to replace the United States as a protector in the Middle East, as a defender of the sea lanes. They have one aircraft carrier, and it's not particularly advanced. They have big limits in what they can do. They're certainly nervous that the United States will no longer provide that security for oil transport that they need, and they're going to try and further develop their diplomatic relationships with others in the Middle East. But when you go to the Middle East, it's driven home to them, again, particularly by the Libya experience, that if things get very ugly, the Chinese can't really help them out. They don't have the military capacity to step in and do for the region what the United States can do when it's performing well. Of course, the United States can have very bad consequences when it does stupid things in the region. So you have to be careful to keep that in mind. But for China and for India, the big story remains increasing consumption. And if you look out over the next decade, two decades, three decades, that's where the growth in global oil consumption comes from. And ultimately, if to turn in part to the environmental side, if we want to see a world where this oil doesn't all get taken out of the ground, we're going to have to turn in a direction where we consume less of it so that prices fall and the incentives go away to extract so much of this oil.
Let's go to our listeners. Simon in Hamden, Connecticut. Simon, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Amazingly interesting topic. I had a question in the context of all of this this increased growth in production. If India does net zero of oil, what are the implications for American citizens, namely that revenue comes from all that increased oil export? How does that calculate, or how does that trickle down, if you will, to the average American citizen? And is all of that revenue something that's privatized and held in the accounts of these companies, or is that something that the American citizens will eventually reap the benefits of?
Simon, you're breaking up, but let us pick it up right there. Michael Levy, what about on the balance of payments ledger? What would that look like if this supply shock comes on, as Antoine's group is saying? On the oil price side, what are the implications? And what about for the U.S. economy and the ordinary American citizen?
The last part is, I find, the most fascinating. You travel, and I've traveled to parts of the country where oil development and natural gas development is happening. And what you find is communities are split. Some people are making a lot of money because they have oil or gas underneath their property. Some people are doing okay, either because they're working in the industry or they're working in places where industry employees frequent, restaurants, mm-hmm. hotels, bars. But there are others who are either afraid for the environmental impacts on their livelihood. They're afraid that water will be contaminated and they depend on that for farming or for other applications. And there are people on fixed incomes who are in areas where you see a major influx of workers, prices going up, but their incomes stay the same. And so a lot of the conflict we have around this is centered on this vastly different impact that this has on different people. What I would say on the bottom line is that there's a broader benefit to the United States, both through the government in terms of royalties when this happens on federal lands, and taxes, corporate taxes as well. You see job growth, which is important given how weak the U.S. economy has been in recent years. And you see some states have taken smart measures to impose what we call a severance tax or some variation on that theme that says, look, even if this oil or gas is under private property, at some level, this is benefiting the country as a whole, and this comes from the country as a whole, and we should take some part of the revenues and use it to benefit the communities, train people to work in the business, make sure the roads are properly kept in order, make sure that the regulator is properly funded so that we can keep this safe. And I think that part is really essential. If you don't make sure that as many people as possible benefit from what's happening, you won't find the support that's necessary to keep it going, and you won't get that same benefit to the communities that you really can if you handle things right.
Of course, the climate affects everyone, and there are catastrophic concerns there. And we'll look at that. Antoine Happ, what about prices here? With North America coming on, if indeed it comes on strong in fossil fuels, even stronger, what does it do to prices in the years ahead, Antoine?
Okay, so this is a touchy subject for the IEA because, as you may or may not know, we try to stay away from forecasting prices. But just looking at the developments in the last few months and last few years, clearly the increase in natural gas production in the U.S. has had a benefit for end users, and it's brought natural gas prices down in a big way. So it's had a very dramatic impact on the U.S. industry, particularly the energy-intensive industries, petrochemicals, refining, some aspects of the metal industry, and so on. So very interesting developments, changing the global market, not just for crude, but for products as well, because refiners now in the U.S. enjoy some of the lowest natural gas prices, lowest energy costs on the planet, and the U.S. refining industry has become a large export industry. You know, just a few years ago, the U.S. was one of the largest or the largest net importer of products in the world. It's now one of the top exporters of products in the world. But when it comes to oil prices, I think end users have not really seen the benefits yet in the U.S. in terms of global balances. The more production you have, the more prices are likely to come under downward pressure. But I think in the U.S. market, what's been striking is that the end users, the consumers, have not really been able to realize the benefit of low energy cost and low crude prices.
And Michael Levy, on the climate side, I mean, if prices are constrained, if supply is so big, we're talking about a supply shock, what happens to the development of renewables, alternative energies? What happens to the climate? We've already got all these warming problems. People saying if we don't leave a lot of these fossil fuels in the ground, we will destroy our climate.
So it's, again, important to think about oil and gas separately. Natural gas right now is mostly replacing coal, which incurs roughly twice as much carbon dioxide emissions when it's burnt. So this abundance of natural gas in the United States is right now good news on the climate side. On the oil side, the underlying phenomenon behind what Antoine is talking about is that when we increase production, others tend to constrain their production in order to keep prices stable. Now, if prices stay relatively stable, people don't buy more oil. You don't go to the gas station and buy more gasoline because you've heard that there's a supply boom in North Dakota. You buy more if the price of gasoline is lower. And so long as the price doesn't get much lower, you don't see big increases in consumption. And as a result, you don't see big increases in greenhouse gas emissions as a result. What I worry about is not that the direct economic impact, the direct market impact of this will hurt us on climate. It's that we're going to get lazy. It's that for years we've looked at cutting oil consumption because we were afraid that we were import dependent, and that as we produce more, maybe we'll be lazier on trying to cut our consumption. I think that would be terrible for climate change. I worry that as people see abundant natural gas, they won't support steps to move forward, whether it's on renewable energy, nuclear power, or other tools that allow us to produce electricity without the greenhouse gas emissions. Again, if we don't do that seriously, then we have a big climate problem. But right now for renewables, the main impact, the main issue is not the abundance of gas, it's policy. And we need to make sure we get that policy right. I could tell you a very quick story. When I was writing my book, I visited a factory outside of Pittsburgh that was making very big panels for solar facilities. Mm. It was only half built because policy had fallen through.
Michael Levy, stand by in New York. The new book is The Power Surge, Energy, Opportunity, and the Battle for America's Future. And Antoine Haff at the IEA in Paris. It's great to have you both with us. We're talking about North America as a new global fossil fuel powerhouse and the implications of that for economies, for the climate. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about North America as fossil fuel powerhouse. The IEA saying growth in the next 5 years. Well, this is the heart of it right here in North America. By 2020, maybe more output than Saudi Arabia by 2030, a kind of energy independence. We've heard about that forever. Antoine Haft joins us from the IEA in Paris. Michael Levy is with us, author of The Power Surge, looking at the geopolitical implications of what's going on. Lots of response online here. William James in Missouri says, it's a good thing, buys America's time we need to weather the baby boom, retirement problems, create some wealth here, capital to develop alternative energy resources, immediate fix to a budget deficit and trade deficit problems, but plenty of others saying, hang on, it's just kicking the energy can down the road. Walk in Ohio says, Chris says it's a curse, gives us a false sense of security. Robert, looking at geopolitical implications, says it'll hit Saudi Arabia, Canada, Mexico. It will strengthen China's relations with each of those countries, says our listener, Robert. Richard Heinberg joins us right now from Santa Rosa, California. He's senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute, author of the forthcoming Snake Oil, author of The End of Growth, thinking about the environmental implications here. Richard Heinberg, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom.
First of all, I know you're not entirely sold on this whole vision of the U.S. becoming, North America become a fossil fuel powerhouse. Do you think the numbers are overblown, Richard?
Well, yes. We did the most comprehensive study to date of the actual production from the 63,000 hydrofractured oil and gas wells in the U.S. And what we found is that there are core areas in each of the plays, whether it's the Bakken or the Marcellus shale gas play or the Eagle Ford in South Texas. There are core areas in each of these plays that are highly productive. But they're being drilled out very rapidly. And once you get outside of those core areas, you see wells that decline in production very rapidly. We're talking about 60-70% declines in productivity within the first year. So yes, over the next 5 years, we definitely will see increasing U.S. oil production from the Bakken and from the Eagle Ford and the Permian in Texas. Mm-hmm. But these will be very short-lived booms in each of these places as the core areas are drilled out and as operators have to move outside those core areas.
Antoine Haft, let me put that to you. Here, one of our listeners, Derek, says the abundance of the Bakken field, North Dakota, may be way oversold, says, as Richard does. He says they're having to drill more and more wells to maintain production, falls off really quickly, takes a lot of water to frack, and the Great Plains in the United States do not have a lot of water. You know, maybe this is a flash in the pan, Antoine. Maybe it doesn't last, this surge.
I think it's true that there's a lot of things we still don't know about this resource. It's still very new, so it's very difficult to make projections beyond 5 or 10 years. We feel very confident that in the next 5 years we're going to see continued increases, assuming certain conditions are in place in terms of logistics and regulations. In terms of decline rates, yes, they're very steep, but the industry also is in the early days of this technique, if you'd like. This application of this technique, the technique itself is quite old, but the application and the new developments are very recent. And we've seen dramatic increases in the productivity of wells in shale formations. The water use, it looks very large if you look at the initial water requirements, but if you look at it over the life of a play, we see that there's a lot of upfront water requirements, but over time it compares quite favorably with more conventional plays, and certainly it compares not necessarily badly with other industries, farming and others. So I think it has to be put in perspective. We feel that in the next few years this resource will be there. Beyond 2025, we have to reassess things, but we also think that you have to look at this supply in broader context. And the broader context is that we see constraints on production in other parts of the world. So some conventional players will benefit from the new technologies in some ways. But we also see security problems in North Africa. We see lingering impacts from the Arab Spring in terms of security and the investment climate in some of the countries where we've seen political change. So this supply, I think, would be very much needed. And just because there's going to be a surge in production in the U.S. doesn't necessarily mean that there's going to be an overabundance of oil resources globally.
Richard Heinberg, what about the climate and environmental implications? So it could be this surge could be, you know, shallower and shorter or deeper and longer. We'll see how long this revolution in techniques goes on and how long people will stand for it, whether they're not happy with some of the side effects. But what about the climate implications if we unleash this much new fossil fuel supply?
Right. Well, we're handcuffing ourselves to an energy regime that's headed toward a cliff. And this is true from both an environmental and an economic perspective. You know, the oil industry has increased its capital expenditures by about 100%. It's about doubled its capital expenditures in the last decade, and it's had to in order to go out to these kinds of risky plays. And that's what's driven oil prices to the place where they are now. And that is part of what's holding our economy back from expanding. At the same time, James Hansen, our foremost American climate scientist, has said that the tar sands make climate change unsolvable. We just hit 400 parts per million this last month. We'll be at 450 parts per million in just a couple of decades. If you look at how much oil we can burn between the years 2000 and 2050 in order to keep us within 2 degrees Celsius global warming, which is the boundary that the scientific community has decided to call dangerous and irreversible climate change, we've already burned half of that. So we should be reducing our global oil consumption by about 6% per year between now and 2050. Instead, what we see is this enormous outcry over what in historic terms would have been a relatively small increase in global oil production. And it's distracted us from really the job of the century, which is to get off of fossil fuels. This is humanity's task in the 21st century, and we're not doing it.
Michael Levy, never mind geopolitics for a moment. What about just domestic politics and how we handle this new supply sitting in front of us of fossil fuels up against exactly what Richard Heinberg is describing there, humanity's challenge for this century to get off of fossil fuels? How do you see this playing out, Michael, in terms of how far our exploitation of these resources does or does not go?
I think Richard has pointed correctly at the decisions we make as being critical to whether we tackle these problems. The reality is that if we insist on not developing American natural gas, we'll be using more coal. If we insist on not developing oil here, we'll be using more oil from somewhere else. But if we pursue these sorts of fuel economy standards that the administration put in place in its first term and intensify those efforts and extend them, we'll consume less. And if other countries do that, we'll bring the price down and there won't be an incentive to develop this anymore. And we would be better off as a result. If we continue to push forward on renewable energy, we will become stronger. If we see gains like we did from Tesla over the last 2 weeks, announcing its first ever quarterly profit and sales higher than the Prius did in its first year in North America, we'll again continue to see gains. But I'm scared about the politics of this because after a decade of at least some cooperation on energy, bipartisan energy bills in 2005, 2007, two presidential candidates in 2008 fighting over whose cap and trade program was better.
Yep.
And people like me who care about climate change thought that was fantastic. Now instead we have these zero-sum wars, these endless battles where either you love fossil fuel production and hate clean energy and efficiency, or it's exactly the other way around. The reality is that history shows that one side does not fundamentally triumph over the other. They both beat each other down, and we get less of each. In the 1970s, we had booms in oil production after prices came up, and we saw consumption fall. And by the 1980s, we'd locked ourselves in fights, and we saw oil production declining, clean energy research starved of money, fuel economy standards no longer tightened. Everyone lost, and we were all worse off in the end.
There's the potential curse side of this. Let's go to our listeners again. Steve in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Steve, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I'd like to just hear what your panel has to say about the idea that American politicians at the behest of big oil is mis-selling the Keystone Pipeline. They're making this sound like that this is something that America will control, that this is North America's oil, when As we all know, oil is fungible. It goes on the world market, and we have no ownership over that at all. Even some of the refineries are run by Saudi Arabia or Aramco. And at the same time, here we've got a nasty product that takes a lot of fresh water, which will be the ultimate resource to get it out of the ground. It's so nasty that you've got to heat it in the pipeline to push it through, and then really does nothing for the United States. Canada is going to build that pipeline somehow, like your guest said, but Canada build it to the Pacific Ocean in Canada if they need to. Why would we need to do this other than a few jobs in construction? The Keystone Pipeline adds nothing to the United States and has a high risk to our environment.
Steve, let us pick it up right there if we can. Richard Heinberg, first of all, what about the assertion that the pipeline will be built somewhere to harvest those tar sands resources? Do you believe that? And, you know, what about the climate cost here? James Hansen says, you know, it's a game changer. It changes it for defeat on climate terms. Do you believe it will stay in the ground somehow? How would that happen?
Well, I think we, as a society, we have to make a decision about this source of fuel. It's the dirtiest source of oil on the planet, and it's not making oil cheaper for us because it's expensive oil to produce. We found that out back in 2009 when the price of oil plummeted temporarily and new tar sands projects were immediately halted because it requires a high price to produce this stuff. Right now, North American prices for oil are a little less than global prices, and the oil industry wants to raise North American oil prices so that they're equal with the global price. And the only way to do that is to have oil be more fungible and more mobile within the North American continent, and that means more pipelines. The same thing with natural gas. The only reason that the natural gas industry wants to export U.S. natural gas is to increase the price of gas for North American users. The U.S. is still a net natural gas importer, but the price has been driven down by a temporary supply glut, and it's actually below the cost of production in most cases. So the goal of all of this is not to lower prices for American consumers. It's actually to raise them.
The goal is to raise them because of infrastructure costs, you're saying?
Well, yes, the infrastructure costs are very high. But if tar sands oil can be more easily exported from North America, then the North American users will be competing with foreign users. Also, there's a temporary glut in Cushing, Oklahoma, of both tar sands and tight oil. And the only way to alleviate that is with more pipelines, getting that oil to refiners on the Gulf Coast. And once that happens, that's also going to serve to increase North American prices.
Richard Heinberg, you know the power of energy sources, you know, once they're tapped into and once a new technology is on the market, once it's being rolled out. And how do you picture this playing out over the next couple of decades? Antoine's group is talking about the next 5 years and then looking at 2020, 2030. Do you think North America, or never mind the tar sands for a minute, even within our own United States borders, do you think we're going to go hell for leather for these fossil fuels or exercise restraint somehow? Are you looking at climate change dreams of a, you know, cleaner, cooler planet and saying game over with this or not?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that the conversation has changed about energy in the U.S. The conversation had been, well, for a number of reasons, climate just being one of them, but also energy security and so on, we should get off of fossil fuels as quickly as we can. But now with these new supplies of shale gas and tight oil, the conversation is, well, what are we going to do about all this new abundance? And the discussion about how we get off of fossil fuels has just gone past the back burner. I mean, an energy policy of all of the above is basically no energy policy at all. And as I said at the beginning, we're handcuffing ourselves to an energy regime with no future. At the current rate of growth in capital expenditures, the fossil fuel industry is going to require basically 10% of U.S. GDP in just a decade in order to keep production flat. Basically, really will be using so much capital in the fossil fuel industry that extra capital to invest in renewable sources of energy will seem like an unaffordable luxury. And meanwhile, as the quality of resources declines, as we pick the low-hanging fruit and are forced to dig even deeper for lower quality tar sands and refrack already fracked wells and so on, the price of energy can only go up. So the only way out of this is with policy, is to decide that we are going to have to get off of fossil fuels, and the best time to do it is as soon as possible.
Frack and refrack. Michael Levy, we just got half a minute. If you were energy czar, what would your policy be, Michael?
My policy would be a most of the above policy, not an all of the above one, because Richard is right that there's some stupid things we shouldn't be doing. We need to be producing safely. We need to be not consuming so much coal and not consuming so much oil. But we do have opportunities in oil and gas and in renewables and efficiency, and we should be pursuing all of those in smart ways.
And figure out a way to get renewables in a big way into that mix, or it sounds like we're in trouble, even with all these new supplies coming on. Antoine Haff at the IEA in Paris, which got everybody's attention with its latest projections last week. Mr. Haff, thank you very much for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Richard Heinberg at the Post-Carbon Institute in Santa Rosa, California, author of Snake Oil, How the Petroleum Industry's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. Look for it forthcoming. Richard, thanks for your time today.
It's been a pleasure, Tom. Thanks.
And Michael Levy, author of The Power Surge. Thank you very much for joining us, Michael.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.